to the Silent London Podcast. And you have no idea how excited I am to be able to say this. Greetings from sunny California. I'm here for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, a four-day event held at the historic Castro Theatre in the heart of San Francisco. I have long dreamed of attending this festival, and this year I was lucky enough to be in a very, very, very small way part of the festival and also to come over to California to see it for myself. Many of you will know that the San Francisco Silent Film Festival is more than a festival. This is its 22nd year running as a film festival, but also the San Francisco Silent Film Festival burst their remit. They are involved in restorations, collaborating with archives worldwide, and for example, a few years ago they held a rather magnificent weekend of screenings of Napoleon, that little film you may have heard about a few times. Because of their close relationship with archives around the world, the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, which is quite a mouthful to say, it turns out, is able to show a really broad variety of silent film. We may be in California, but it's not all Hollywood here. We have films from all over the world, and we have musicians from all over the world, and, you know, writers and curators and introducing the films. Those. It does feel like a very international event, like a Pordenone, but with more palm trees, really, and more sunshine. All the films are screened at the historic Castro Theatre in the heart of the Castro District in San Francisco, as I said, and it's a 1920s building, and it really is so ornate. I can't quite grasp how beautiful it is. It's very grand inside, velvet seats, you know, the walls are covered in frescoes and gilt, and the ceiling has this very ornate giant ceiling rose, and this massive screen with big sort of mustard gold curtains. It's also a real working cinema that is, you know, showing films all the time. The moment they're advertising Sing Along a La La Land, as well as a whole programme of rep screenings. So, you know, when you walk in, you've got the opulence of a vintage cinema, but you've also got the familiar smell of popcorn, and the screenings themselves are really special. So the opening screening this year was on the Thursday night, a screening of the Freshman, Harold Lloyd's comedy The Freshman. So student comedy, and we actually had a student silent film orchestra, slightly more than that, the Barclay Silent Film Orchestra. It was really quite special, and I thought maybe it was because it was a comedy and it was a Hollywood film, because there were students involved, there was a lot of whooping and cheering and clapping and yelling with delight and laughing everything. I think we had applause for the first intertitle, applause for every logo from an archive, rounds and rounds of applause during the speeches before the film. And I thought, well, you know, maybe that's the opening night. Maybe everyone's particularly boisterous. But no, actually, as the festival has gone on, I've seen that people are that engaged, that vocal with everything. And I'm beginning to think that maybe the uptight European crowds could learn a little from their enthusiasm. Maybe it's a little much for me sometimes, but you've got no doubt that people in the cinema are really engaging with these films and responding to the involvement of people in bringing these films to the screen. So you're getting the cheers for the musician, but also for the archivists and the restorers and so on. I was thinking, God, I'd love to introduce a film here. I'd try and, like, burst a record for how many little whoops I could get by mentioning as many people and places as possible. So there's a sort of serious side to the festival this year, which is that the festival is dedicated to David Shepherd, the well-known, well-respected, loved, hugely important film preservationist who sadly died earlier this year. And there were a couple of events that particularly paid tribute to him. We had a little toast to him on the mezzanine where a few archivists gathered, and lots of people spoke very highly of him. And then on the Saturday morning, actually, Serge Bromberg, who was a close friend of his, showed a programme of films, just favourite shorts of his. Yeah, there were a lot of French films. We had Méliès, Gaston Vell, Emile Cole. We had the famous Dancing Pig. Some really bizarre and quirky films that David had loved or had a special connection to him. We even had Charlie Chaplin in The Masquerader, one of his less well-known shorts, actually. Other than that, it's really hard to know what order to tackle the films in. I'm going to stick with the archive theme for a minute. The festival gives out an award to an archiver or an archivist each year, and this year it was the iFilm Institute in Amsterdam, Netherlands Film Institute that won the award, and the film that they showed after collecting the the award, the I film that they showed was an action caper called Philibus. Philibus is the name of an international sort of criminal, obviously a criminal mastermind, who in this case happens to be a woman. Not just a woman, but a woman who drags up quite a lot. She has a lot of outlandish contraptions, including a kind of tin can suspended from an aircraft, and which seems to be operated by telephone, and all kinds of shenanigans. But she also drags up, and she's got two separate male personas. One, just a simple burglar with a mask, and another, a mustachioed count. She's very audacious. You know, some of these things can seem quite silly, but it's kind of gaslighting. She has the detective on her trail, and her intention seems to be to prove to the detective that the detective is actually the criminal. And she proves this, you know, with fingerprints, photographs, and all manner of evidence. And while she's doing this, she's also courting the detective's sister. Yeah, pretty audacious, villainous, slightly queer character. And I really enjoyed the film, as I'm sure you can tell. But also, there was something about saying, you know, look at us, we're an important film archive, and this is what you get from us. One of my favourite events was Friday morning, a section called Amazing Tales from the Archives. Now, as a writer, I can tell you that, you know, calling something amazing is pretty dangerous. You know, can you live up to the billing? But yeah, these were quite amazing tales. We had three presentations. First, we had George Willimon, who talked about kinetophone films. Basically, you know, so we're talking about early Edison talking pictures where you've got a film and you've got a wax cylinder recording of sound to go with it. And so he showed us some examples. That's great. There's a great one with some blacksmiths, you know, doing a kind of barbershop quartet number. And also another one, we had a practical joke about pretending people were deaf so that you had to shout. Yeah, not quite as offensive as that sounds. But what I really enjoyed about his presentation, the way that he's talked about all the logistics of how you would film these kinetophone films, moving the phonograph cylinder around by means of a pole, just like a boom mic, really, to make sure it caught the sound, and also things like, you know, laying out cords on the studio floor to make sure people stayed within range. Yeah, it's far more complicated than even you might think, and talking about how big a wax cylinder needs to be to record 6 minutes of data, which is quite funny when I think that I'm speaking to an iPhone right now. The second, we actually had Elif Rongan Kanachi, I think I've said that very badly, but she gave a really fascinating presentation. I'm sure a lot of people will have heard of the name John Desmet because of the Desmet collection, and normally we talk about the films that are in John Desmet's collection, sort of like nearly 1,000 films, I think, are in that collection. But Elif's presentation was all about the life of John Desmet, and you know, I always think it's pretty much a solid gold certainty that when you're talking about early film people, whether it be early filmmakers, but particularly early film showmen, and that's really what John Desmet was. He was an early cinema owner, exhibitor, film rental agency. You will find that they are quite colourful characters. She had some really amazing details about the things that he'd got up to, even just showing that he, when he was working in the fairgrounds, he lived in this caravan, and he used to charge people 10 cents to have a look around it. And she showed us some pictures of the interior of this caravan, and you think, God, I'd pay more than 10 cents. Beautiful, sort of like a beautiful Art Nouveau apartment, panelled and ornate, and yeah, just in his caravan. I particularly like the fact that later in life, after his sort of film exhibiting career was over, he was always coming up with new wheezes, and one of them was something called cloud projection. So the idea is that you project advertising into the sky, the way to get your message across. Yeah, just like a bat signal. I never thought I'd see the bat signal at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. The third presentation was by Heather Linville from the Academy Film Archive, and I swear to you, I'm not making this name up. She gave a presentation about Aloha Wanderwell, an early traveller and travel filmmaker, a woman who signed up to join an expedition, a kind of endurance race across Europe, across the world, in fact, in Model T Fords. She signed up as a secretary when she was just a teenager, and by the time she was 18, I think she'd travelled the world, she'd made all these films, really short films, because they could only carry and develop so much films they were going on. Well, not short films, but short snippets of films that were stitched into longer films that she would lecture. Her life was pretty incredible. The film itself is pretty incredible. And I'm just kind of in love with this sort of lanky teenager called Aloha Wanderwell who ran away to see the world and brought it back home. I really hope that you get to see some of her footage. So there isn't possibly time enough to tell you everything that I saw, especially in any kind of detail, but there are a few highlights. I'm going to try and pick out some highlights. And my second highlight was a double bill on the first full day of the festival. Who can resist a double bill of Louise Brooks and Clara Bow, especially little or unseen Louise Brooks and Clara Bow? So the Clara Bow film was Get Your Man, which, yeah, as we all know, Clara Bow always got her man. In this film, she's paired with Buddy Rogers, who's just sweet as ever. And Clara Bow and Buddy Rogers play a couple who meet in Paris, of course, and spend the night in a waxworks museum, which they have quite a bit of fun with. And although they're in love, unfortunately, Buddy Rogers has been betrothed to another woman since he was an infant, and the girl in question was a baby, so they can't get married. And so you'd think, but Clara Bow being both determined and amorous and very sneaky and cheeky, she finds a way, and it's very entertaining to watch. Now, unfortunately, this film does not survive, you know, in entirety, but we had a restoration that sort of papered over the cracks with a few intertitles and stills, and yeah, you just can't resist Clara Bow. And you know, when I say that the audience could be very vocal, they were really vocal with this one. When it finally seems that Clara Bow's scheme, sorry, spoiler alert, has worked out, and despite it looking like she was doing everything but getting her man, and she's going to get her man, I swear to you that someone in the audience screamed, yes, 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 before Clara Bow. And what could be more fitting, we had Louise Brooks. Now, this really was something special. Rob Byrne, the president of the board of directors of the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, had, after what may have been a... it's not sure exactly how well-informed a tip it was from Kevin Brownlow, whether it was a punt or whether he knew exactly what he was sending off for, has found a few fragments of an otherwise lost Louise Brooks film. It's called Now We're in the Air. Now, like many a Louise Brooks film, we will think of it as a Louise Brooks film, but it certainly wasn't made like that at the time. So this is a Raymond Hatton and Wallace Beery comedy. Now, Louise Brooks was very clear that she thought that they were not a funny combination. And also, I think really early in her career, she said something like, what she really didn't want to do is play the pretty girl who stands still while a man is funny around her. Well, in Now We're in the Air, that's exactly the role she's given. Plays twins, and she's got two apparently funny men running rings around her. So I find that Raymond Hatton and Wallace Beery are pretty flappy and twitchy and very much a sort of bargain basement Laurel and Hardy gurning, and, you know, that sort of comedy element wasn't to my taste. It's set during the war, so they're in France, and Louise Brooks plays two French twins in a circus, and they are US airmen who are getting into scrapes. There are three fragments, and only one of them has Louise Brooks in. So mostly you're seeing Hatton and Beery get up to no good. Louise Brooks, though, however, even though she is given so little to do, she has such poise. She has such grace and such poise, and, you know, there's not much to say except that her statuesque quality, the limpid grace, the elegance of her really show up the frenetic comedy around her, and you can see how people remain, like, drawn to her. She's not doing much, but she is being Louise Brooks. You may know, if you know the film Pandora's Box, there's that scene in the casino boat where a deal is done to sell Lulu, Louise Brooks' character, into a brothel, and they do this by showing photographs of Lulu to this Egyptian character. And the photographs in question are not photographs of Louise Brooks dressed as Lulu, they are publicity shots of Louise Brooks herself. They're, you know, Hollywood shots, and it's quite a creepy choice that was made to do that. And one of them you might know is Louise Brooks in a black tutu with a G on the front, and that is a costume from Now We're in the Air. So whatever else is not thrilling about Now We're in the Air, what is great is to see a still that's used in this rather sleazy way in a much more famous film come to life. And, you know, anything that shows us more Louise Brooks and more of how she had a particular quality that is rarely matched, that's very welcome. And, you know, I've been rather hard on the film, but, you know, I was absolutely on the edge of my seat to watch it.
When the winds are blowing and the snow is starting in the fall, then my eyes turn westward, knowing that's the place that I love best of all. California, I've been blue since I've been away from you. I can't wait till I get going, even now I'm starting in the call.
I'm a must confess, it's only really in the past couple of years, I think, that I've actually studied the lineup for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. Prior to that, I didn't really appreciate how much material and what a variety of material and how much, as I say, new material, new restorations, new discoveries was shown here. This podcast is really just my attempt to share that with you, and so I couldn't possibly go through everything that was shown at the festival and all the scores, but I really wanted to pick out a few highlights. One of the first things I want to talk about is a film that I had actually seen before, but I just wanted to join the chorus of people that are evangelising about 2 Days, which is a Ukrainian silent film. I've got to admit, it's not in the best state. This is a film from 1927, and I saw it a few years ago at the Pordenone Silent Film Festival, and it did leave quite an impression on me and quite a few of the other people there. It played here at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival with a different score, with a score by Stephen Horn, and I know he'd put quite a lot of work into it. It's a tricky film to score in many ways because it's all about conflict, but it's set in quite a small space, and there's something rather gruesome that happens to a poor innocent puppy early on. Yeah, definitely, that was something that I remembered from seeing it before, but I hadn't realised quite how harrowing that particular sequence is and how important it is to the whole story. So it's set during the Ukrainian Civil War, and it's about a kind of faithful servant, an old retainer, who is protecting his master's property while they flee the conflict, the war zone that is their home. A couple of things happen to complicate that. One, the small boy who lives in the house gets separated from his family and he returns back to the homestead, but then a group of Bolsheviks arrive and they take over the house and are quite keen to ransack it. One of the Bolsheviks is the servant's son. So it's all about war, it's all about conflict, it's all about a clash of values and a clash of generations. It's very intense. I mean, they were talking a lot about like German expressionism. I don't know whether that's really the right thing to say, but there's a lot of high contrast photography in this print. There's a lot of deep dark shadows, and yes, you know, the faithful old servant does have a quality that is reminiscent of Emil Jannings in The Last Laugh. It's a harrowing film, but it's also very fascinating, and it moves at a fast pace. I thoroughly recommend it. It's not necessarily going to please everyone. I think, you know, it's not an easy watch, but I'm really glad to get a chance to see it again. You know, in Pordenone, things run in the middle of a long, long programme, and this was part of a strand of Ukrainian films, so it's nice to see it highlighted by itself here, and you know, it was shown to a whole new audience, so that was great. San Francisco itself, as you probably know, is one of the most cinematic of cities. You know, everybody knows about Vertigo and Bullet and every film ever set in Alcatraz or near Alcatraz. And of course, Edward Muybridge made a lot of his early pre-cinema experiments here. So, you know, his panoramas and such like. So, you know, you do feel like you're living in a very cinematic city. A film that I saw at the festival that, you know, maybe wasn't one of the greatest films, but makes the most of San Francisco as a film location, is Outside the Law. This really is a kind of crime thriller, and people are talking about it being a kind of proto-Dashiell Hammett, you know, Dashiell Hammett before Dashiell Hammett kind of film. It's set in San Francisco, and it's directed by Todd Browning. Lon Chaney's in there as well in the cast, but the person that really shines is Priscilla Dean as a criminal. She was known, I think, they said in the introduction, Eddie Muller's introduction said that she was known as the Queen of Crookdom, and she really has a very minxy way about her. She's very strong, she's very capable, and in this film, she gets involved in sort of, you know, one last job, and then there's a lot of discussion about whether or not, you know, they're going to go straight and how straight they're going to go. Will they give back the spoils? And you see all this play across her face, and she's just completely watchable. Another thing that is particularly strong and memorable about the film is there's a very good child actor in it who plays the boy across the hall from our villainous couple, and he's just, he's very personable. You can't forget him. Very sweet and boisterous little kid. But also, yeah, I don't know whether this is on purpose, maybe this is Todd Browning's sense of humour, but he plays with a lot of dangerous toys. You know, axes and hammers and bits of wood and even the gun. Yeah, there were gasps from the audience, and obviously there were a lot of gasps from the local audience because they recognised lots of the locations. And at one point, the film makes a terrible, terrible faux pas by calling Knob Hill, Knob Hill with a K, and you could tell that just was hilarious to the locals. Elsewhere, of course, you know, really it's making the most of showing sort of different neighbourhoods, very sort of grand mansions and an apartment block on a hill with a mass massively impressive view of the city, and of course Chinatown, where a certain criminal and reforming element live in the film story. They say you have to rep your ends, so I'm going to talk about Friday night, when we had a little British invasion of the Castro Theatre, introduced by Bryony Dixon and accompanied by Stephen Horn, with also Gunter Buchwald and Frank Bocchius, The Informer. Yeah, so you probably, at this point, I'm guessing you've probably seen The Informer. It's a thriller. It's based on the Liam O'Flaherty novel. It's directed by Arthur Robison, so it really has a kind of expressionist quality. It stars Lia Dupuytie, Lars Hansen and Warwick Ward, with Carl Harbord. And it's a beautiful British silent. It's really a kind of European silent that's made in Britain, because it's a bit of a co-production. It's got so many cast members and crew members from across the continent. It's really very accomplished. Now, if you've seen it on a DVD or the recent archive gala, you'll have seen it with Garth Knox's score, which I do think is actually excellent, but the horn score, as it were, does bring something different. It really emphasises, and I don't know whether this will appear to you, the sense of paranoia and dread and fear that pervades this story, which is all about suspicion and guilt. Just absolutely magnificent to see it on the big screen in this beautiful venue so far away from home, and to go down so well. I mean, a couple of people sort of popped by to say that they thought it was their favourite screening of the festival. I actually wrote the programme notes for the screening, and at some point I think they might be appearing on the website, so I'll make sure there's a link from Silent London to those. I mentioned Raymond Hatton earlier when I was talking about the Louise Brooks film, and he actually appeared again on screen in a film called Silence, which is a lost film that's been rediscovered, and it is a Rupert Julian directed film, but Cecil B. DeMille produced. It stars H.B. Warner as a man who's walking to the gallows for a crime he did not commit, and it's told in flashback. It's a kind of melodrama with Vera Reynolds playing two generations, a mother and daughter, and the very sad story H.B. Warner's character is played out. I have to say that I thought this film was very strong. It has a particularly strong opening sequence where the guilt and fear is demonstrated by actually percussive, dynamic, rhythmic elements, the swinging of the gallows, of the pendulum of the clock, the hammering of nails. And that's so tense and so strong that actually the rest of the film feels a little bit conventional by contrast. Actually, when we talk about Raymond Hatton, we also have to talk about Wallace Beery. And there we go, we did see on the Sunday afternoon a gorgeous new restoration of The Lost World, tinting and toning and little flashes of fire, really elevating this animated jungle adventure to, you know, just exactly the kind of blockbuster entertainment it's born to be. Serge Bromborg came on stage beforehand to tell us exactly what had happened to make this restoration possible, and I think it was about 11 different elements. Yeah, so it's a complicated story, but what you have is a really luscious print of the film. Everything looks crisp and clear, which is great when you really want to see all the intricate movements of the animation, and the very ambitious and creative score from the Allo Orchestra, which was played live there, you know, really brought it to life. I really hope this podcast has given you a flavour of the festival. There's something really charming and really welcoming about this festival. It's obviously in a big city, but because it's all centred on the same venue, there is a kind of heart to it. And a lot of people, I really wasn't prepared for this, but a lot of people really enter into the spirit of the festival by dressing in vintage gear. I mean, yeah, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in San Francisco are quite expressive people. That's definitely what I've learned this weekend, possibly more so in London. But that really fed into the whole atmosphere of the event. It's a fun kind of atmosphere inside the theatre. We have introductions for each film from a wide variety of people, so that was really good, and a lot of those were really entertaining. And also there's a booming voice from the back of the room sort of, welcome to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, which added a lot of joy. And just on a practical note, all the films are shown in English, as it were, so if it's not a film made in the English language, there will be English subtitles, but there are no other translations, except for all the introductions, etc., are translated into American Sign Language, which I thought was a nice touch, because I've no idea whether there's a large deaf audience for the festival, but obviously that just makes the whole thing a little bit more inclusive. So would I come back to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival? That is the question. Yes, obviously, I'd be delighted to. It's a beautiful city, and this is a really incredible festival, and it's just full of new ideas, and feels like a really sort of joy in the medium. One of the things I think that means that I'd never quite appreciated quite how much they show is that the films here are not organised into strands, so you can't look at it and go, this yeah, we're doing Myrna or anything like that. It's just a sort of grab bag of things. But it still feels quite carefully curated, and I did feel that we had a broad variety of film. I think there is a slight lean towards Hollywood, but, you know, we had films from Ukraine, from Poland, from Britain. You know, we had Russia, obviously, and Sweden. So I think, you know, I think we're doing fairly well here. Just even, oh, yeah. My Airbnb landlady is a very, very keen on German cinema particularly, and she was very pleased that they were showing Ernst Lubitsch's Die Puppe, and who wouldn't be? That film was just absolutely hilarious. Any film, any festival that has room for that is obviously a very good one. Oh yes, of course, there was a Japanese film of Age of Madness supported by the Alloy Orchestra on Saturday night. So yeah, it's been an absolute privilege to be here, and it's been a joy to be able to share some of it with you. I hope that this helps you if you're thinking of making the trip, or possibly just added to your jealousy. The good news is, even if you can't afford a trip to California, that the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, as I said at the top of the podcast, is full of plots and schemes. So you get to see a lot of their work at festivals around the world, possibly a few of them closer to home, because they're always finding and restoring new films. And definitely some of the rediscoveries here, I hope that we'll be seeing in Britain and in Europe soon. There's not much for me to say, except to say thank you so much to San Francisco Silent Film Festival, the organisers and the team, you know, obviously Stacey, Anissa, Lucy and Robert, of course, and also to all the wonderful people I met here. I mean, I talked about this festival being a meeting point for international archives, but also for film writers and film fans. I met so many brilliant people, and everyone was so welcoming and helpful and chatty. And, you know, you're sitting there at this festival and you're seeing wonderful film, and then in the break you go and have a burrito and talk about Marion Davis with a brand new pal. I've definitely made some new friends and some new contacts, and, you know, what a treat to be able to look at this passion of mine from a perspective so very different, so very far from the BFI South Bank. Thanks so much for listening, and I will be speaking to you again very soon.
I left my heart. San Francisco. High on a hill. It calls to me. To be well, little cable cars. Climb halfway to the stars. The morning fog may chill the air. I don't care, my love waits there.